right, please be seated, and we'll resume with the fifth case, Weddington versus Hanks. Mr. Worley. And Mr. Flores, we have you by telephone.
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right, I appreciate you participating by phone.
I express my gratitude to the court for permitting me to do so.
All right. Mr. Worley, go ahead.
Your Honors, may it please the court. It's March 13th, 2012 order. The court granted Mr. Weddington's request for a certificate of appealability and identified four issues for appointed counsel to address. I'd like to focus on the recusal issue, as it's critically important to the justice system, but I'm prepared to discuss the other three issues if needed. Here, the district court judge failed to recuse herself, even though she presided over Weddington's closely related 2003 state court trial, and this was plain error. Under 28 U.S.C. 455A, the standard...
Let me ask you this, Mr. Worley. I appreciate the problem of a judge sitting on a case that would be closely related to a case that he or she had presided on before, but this case was screened off because of being untimely, and it seems to me you have to get pretty deep into the... into the petition, habeas petition, to even get a clue that there could be a relationship between the case that was subject to the habeas and the other case. That's troubling to me.
Your Honor, I respect that, and the issue of recusal really comes up before even entering into the briefs, that my client should have an unbiased judge to view the briefs. And this similar issue happened in Clemens v. Wolf in the 3rd District, where the case was dismissed at the district court level based solely on procedural grounds, as was the case here. Yet that court held that the judge should have recused himself in that situation. And as was the case here, and there were issues in the habeas petition which were at issue in the 2003 trial as well.
Well, yes, when you really dig in, there's this stop that took place in January of whatever year it was, and the results of the stop led to investigations on both lines of cases. But not to say state court judges can't remember some things they work on, but there are a lot of things that come past a state court judge's attention. And how would this judge have known that this was related to something that she had handled previously?
Your Honor, the standard actually isn't that she actually knew. It's just that there's a reasonable appearance, an objective standard. And as the case law holds, and as our view is that there was a reasonable appearance because she had previously ruled on a motion to suppress that was at issue in this case. And as you mentioned, there were many common issues of fact present based on the investigation and arrest. And additionally, just the natures of a serial rape are so memorable and serial in nature that her impartiality may be reasonably questioned. And as I mentioned, the case most on point here, and was identified in the court granting the certificate of appealability, is Clemens v. Wolf, which is a Third Circuit case from 2004. In that case, held that a district court judge must recuse themselves if any issue concerning the trial or conviction over which the district court presided over a state court judge, and they remanded the case. Here, there's clearly an issue at present, which is the motion to suppress. Judge Pratt was asked to rule on a motion that she already dealt with as in the 2003 state court trial. And that goes back to the overarching principle that was discussed in Clemens, that no judge should hear or determine an appeal based on an issue they previously tried by them. In addition to Clemens, this court, the Seventh Circuit, and Russell v. Lane held the same principle true. The only difference was that in Russell v. Lane, the state court judge was a state appellate court judge rather than a trial judge, which is the case in Clemens and here. Here, respondent relies on a technicality that this appeal follows the 2005 trial and not the 2003 trial. This argument is without merit for a few reasons, some of which we've already discussed. And the first of which is the motion to suppress. The motion to suppress was for a traffic stop that led to the discovery as Weddington's status as a serial rapist. This was brought up in the habeas petition in count 45. In addition to the motion to suppress...
There you go, 45. That's pretty deep into the petition. And the petition begins as a petition for belated habeas corpus, which would seem to me to draw the district court judge's attention to the timeliness, whether this is a timely petition. That's sort of a threshold, more than sort of, it's a threshold issue as to whether the merits, whether you ever get to paragraph 45.
Right, Your Honor, and I'm not saying that Judge Pratt...
There were 160-some claims?
That's correct. It was a pro se motion, quite a few claims. It doesn't mean that any one count is less important than the other. The fact that it was, that the district court held that it was untimely is not of issue, because we're not saying that Judge Pratt was actually biased. We're just saying there's a reasonable appearance of bias that existed based on her prior involvement in the 2003 trial.
But there's nothing that's before us now in this appeal that Judge Pratt could have considered at the state court trial, because all of this happened, the filing of this all happens well after that case is over. What I think the point is can we fairly say that there's an appearance of impropriety with respect to an issue that was raised, could not have been raised at the original trial?
I think, Your Honor, I disagree that there was no issue raised. There was a motion to suppress that was present in the 2003 trial and again in the 2005 trial, which Judge Pratt ruled on in the 2003 trial, which is also ultimately raised in the petition. And then in addition to that, there's many other counts and facts that were in the 2003 trial and the 2005 trial that were present. And even in addition to that, there's three other counts in the habeas petition that mention certain factual situations. Those are counts 38, 82, and 85, and they deal with a DNA test, improper arrest, and some DNA evidence used in both the 2003 and 2005 trials. In those counts, petitioner explicitly states that the 2003 trial or things that happened from it were at issue.
And which of those issues did the judge decide in this case?
At what point?
No, what did she say about any of those?
In this case, in the district court, she ruled solely on procedural grounds.
Exactly.
And, Mr. Wehrle, if we were to hold that this proceeding really needed to be dropped, either because the petition's untimely and or because there's no excuse for the procedural default, wouldn't the recusal issue really become harmless error in any event?
In my opinion, no.
Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. The recusal issue comes as an initial step at the district court level. And so everything that happened past that she decided as a procedural reason is tainted, in our opinion, because of her reasonable appearance of bias. And so the fact that she didn't reach the ineffective assistance of counsel claims is of no issue, because what's really important is that there was a reasonable appearance of bias that existed.
But there are two kinds of bias with judges. One is personal bias, which is very rare. You have some disagreement or disapproval of an individual litigant, no matter what the case is. But I think what you're arguing is issue bias, that the court dealt with these issues before, issues that were not reached in this case, and that's where the bias is. But it's difficult to extend that to ruling on timeliness. Because I think the core of your argument is there is some personal bias that this judge has to this individual, so that whatever the case is, whatever the rulings are, if it was an auto accident case, if it was a case involving a complaint that he was beaten up in prison, she can't handle it because she's got some personal bias against wedding.
My argument is that there's both a potential for personal and issue bias in this case. And again, we don't need to prove that she actually was biased, only that there's a reasonable appearance of bias. And based on her role in the 2003 trial and the claims that were brought up in the petition, there was clearly a reasonable appearance of bias. And I'd like to reiterate that in Clemens v. Wilkerson.
Pratt actually recused herself in the state case that she was responsible for after the conviction, after the sentence?
Right. But, well, I mean, she presided over the trial and the sentencing.
Yeah, the sentence was imposed, appeal was taken, and then subsequently she recused herself.
In the state court, right.
She was asked to recuse, wasn't she, by your client?
I believe that's correct, yes.
So does that, how does that play into this case? Was that recusal because of a bias?
You know, I would have to look more into the recusal. I do think that plays into it that she should have remembered when later on, or there's at least a reasonable appearance that she should have remembered that there was a bias earlier and that she had been involved in this case, you know, which came from the same arrest, the same investigation, and was a serial nature of crimes.
But your client did not, while the petition for habeas was at the district court, did not request that the judge recuse.
That's correct.
He was sent notices that would indicate she was presiding over the habeas, wasn't he?
I believe that's correct. I can't speak exactly whether he received those or not. As you know, during a significant portion of these proceedings, he was in segregation, and there were some issues of him having access to legal papers.
Let's get to that for just a moment. If we got to the question of procedural default, you make out, I think, in your brief, a plausible case that on the issue of cause, perhaps this should go a little further. We ought to find out why he wasn't able to file the papers.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to deal with prejudice, too. How do you deal with the prejudice problem?
Right. I mean, it's our opinion that he was clearly prejudiced by having no access to legal papers while in confinement, in segregation. And because of that, he was unable to appeal his post-conviction relief, and he was unable to file his petition. And even when he was returned his legal papers, many of them were missing, including his drafts of both the appeal and his petition. So if there's no further questions, I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
Good enough. How much time left? 2 minutes. All right, Mr. Flores, I assume you've been able to hear that.
I did, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
May it please the Court. Recusal was not warranted here. The district court judge did properly presided over petitioner's habeas case, as she did not participate in any proceeding in the case upon which petitioner seeks habeas relief. First, as Weddington concedes, because he failed to timely object to the district court review of his case, the court reviewed this claim under plain error. And while petitioner did challenge his arrest in both cases, the challenge here under the 2005 case is limited to, as it must, the effectiveness of the trial counsel's performance challenging that arrest. It's important to note in the 2005 case, petitioner proceeded pro se when he challenged his arrest. He was had standby counsel appointed at the time, but from the factual findings by the post-conviction court, we know that standby counsel acted only as a resource. It was petitioner who made decisions regarding his defense. The post-conviction court also noted that during that suppression hearing, it was a 3-day suppression hearing, I believe, he called numerous witnesses and introduced numerous exhibits. In the 2003 case, he had counsel at his suppression hearing. From the record, we don't know whether or not the suppression issue raised in the 2000 case is, I believe, the same as the 2005 case with regards to the factual.
Well, Mr. Flores, though, the appellate court opinion in his 2005 conviction, though, in footnote 9, I think it is, makes direct reference to the prior ruling by Judge Pratt. So, and says it's essentially the same suppression motion.
Right. He does challenge the same arrest. That's correct. But whether or not the same factual assertions were introduced for those motions, I don't think we know. Regardless, the nexus of the cases that petitioner cites and that respondent cites with regards to requiring recusal comes down to whether or not the judge sitting and the reviewing judge has to look at her ruling and make a decision whether or not the ruling or conviction or sentence that she issued or he issued was unconstitutional. That could never happen in this case because in the 2005 case, petitioner proceeded pro se at a suppression issue. So, and ordinarily, pro se petitioner is not entitled to ineffective assistance of counsel, so there would be no prejudice analysis to get to the merits of that claim. Then a freestanding claim on Fourth Amendment grounds would be precluded on habeas review, which is clear here that he did receive a hearing. And as American Tobacco Company, our Supreme Court tells us that we, when we're looking at a motion under 455A, we do need to look at the factual realities of the case. And the factual realities in this case is that a reasonable person, knowing all the circumstances, would not doubt Judge Pratchett's impartiality, especially when she was not required to make any ruling on a ruling she handed down in the state court. Now, even if the court were to find that the district court judge should have recused herself, the proper remedy as set forth by this court in Russell is to merely remand the case to be heard by an impartial judge. Now,
Mr. Flores, do you agree that Judge Pratt, in fact, had recused herself in the state court case after the sentence was imposed?
That's correct. I believe it was upon a motion of the petitioner, and it's unclear why she recused herself, but from reviewing the record, it appears to be it was post-conviction relief was to be conducted, and that's why she probably recused herself. And here, again, petitioner did not seek to alert Judge Pratt, well, in his lengthy petition, that she should have recused herself, that there was any relation to these cases based on its 169 claims and that the fact that there was a third time bar and procedural default in this case. With regards to the procedural grounds why the petition was dismissed, as to his untimeliness, it's clear that the petition was untimely, and Weddington has not sustained his burden to show he's entitled to equitable tolling. First, with regards to extraordinary circumstances outside his control, the record belies his assertions. He, in his petition, makes bold assertions that his records were his materials were confiscated and kept from him for, I believe, over a year. However, respondent submitted an affidavit to rebut those assertions, which clearly sets forth that Weddington was never precluded from accessing his legal materials or accessing the law library.
So, Mr. Flores, doesn't that create a question of fact that needed to be determined?
Yes, Your Honor, that would have created an issue of fact. That's correct. However, even though there's a factual circumstance there, we need to look at whether or not he diligently pursued that claim. And even if we take his assertions as true that he did not receive his record until 2010, he waited until February of 2011 to file a petition. That's partly a showing of diligence, and which Your Honor noted would make any showing of recusal would be harmless based on clear showing of the untimeliness in the case. If there are no further questions, respond with respect to the request that this court affirm the denial of habeas relief.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Worley. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you. I'd like to start by noting that we have recusal to protect the integrity of the judicial system. And to go back to what we were discussing earlier, the fact that she recused herself earlier in the state court trial, the burden was on her then as a federal court judge to recuse herself again. The burden isn't on the prisoner to identify these issues. And to go back and respond to a case that's heavily relied upon by appellee in his briefs, Daniels v. Wilson, which is a very recent Third Circuit decision, which can be distinguished in a few ways, as noted in our reply brief. This case dealt with a judge who issued an arrest warrant and was not required to recuse himself. The fact that the court emphasized that the arrest warrant was so non-discretional and ministerial in nature, and in our case, that's clearly not the issues that she was ruling on. She was ruling on, Judge Pratt was ruling on issues, obviously she presided over an entire trial and sentencing, but she's also ruling on a motion to suppress that had an evidentiary hearing, which was then again brought up in the 2005 trial. In addition, in Daniels, none of the nine issues raised in that petition were raised in the habeas petition. Here, petitioner explicitly raised issues concerning the 2003 trial, as we already discussed. There were at least four explicit mentions in the petition, as well as a number of other common issues. You know, based on the four independent grounds of reversal identified by the court, petitioner requests that the court grant his habeas petition, and at a minimum, the court should remand this to the district court and reassign the case to an unquestionably impartial judge. Without any further questions.
All right, Mr. Worley, thank you, and thanks to both counsel, but a special thanks to you and your firm, Foley & Lardner, for accepting appointment in this case and representing the petitioner in the highest tradition of the bar.
Thank you.
Thank you.